Bowery Capital Startup Sales Podcast with your host, Evan McElwain.
Welcome back to the Bowery Capital Startup Sales Podcast. I'm Evan McElwain, Bowery Capital's Director of Growth. And this week, we are joined by Chris Williams, co-founder and managing director of Wolves Not Sheep, to talk about early stage startup positioning. Great to have you on the show, Chris.
Hey, Evan. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Chris, tell us more about you, your background, and the current company that you founded, Wolves Not Sheep.
Yeah, man. My background started in design, actually. So most of my career leading up to Wolves was pretty linear. I'm starting as an art director and then making my way up to directing creative teams and ultimately the creative direction of the company that I last worked for, serving as their chief creative officer. So kind of during all of that time, I've had the privilege of working on a very eclectic mix of business types and stages, which range in category and scale. So anything from like your mom and pop corner retailers to global enterprises selling suites of products. So over time, I actually began to notice a pattern across all of them in which money was being thrown at marketing and advertising to attack the symptoms of their declining sales rather than addressing the root cause of the problem. And I had met my co-founder at the last agency I worked at, and he had noticed a lot of the same things, but from the tech and product development side. So long story short, we launched Wolves Not Sheep as a positioning studio to attack those issues that were getting in the way of enabling more success and that higher future growth. And so our focus is on shaping and expressing the value of what the company is trying to build and ultimately do that in a way that attracts best fit customers, investors, even recruiting top talent.
Awesome. So sounds like you live and breathe this stuff all day long and so excited to kind of dig into early stage startup positioning more today. One question before we do dive in that we always like to ask our guests is, you know, what is one thing that no one listening to this podcast will know about you?
So I've been thinking about this question a lot and ultimately decided to pick something that I think even my mom wouldn't know. Yeah, so she's listening. Sorry, mom. But I feel like every entrepreneur kind of has their quote unquote lemonade stand story, right? So mine actually was in the third grade and had nothing to do with lemonade at all. Before I got into all things design, I used to draw a lot as a kid. And one day while I was bored in class, I drew an eight ball on my arm because at the time, not to date myself, that was a thing. And a kid sitting next to me saw it and asked if I'd draw one on his at recess. So as I was doing that drew kind of a small crowd. And then that soon spread to another and another. And all of it led to creating my own flash art of tattoo options to pick from. So I started charging like milk money and vending machine money from classmates just to draw temporary tattoos for everybody. Right. And it didn't really last long. Teachers didn't really love it. Parents were getting a little upset. So those phone calls of like, hey, or calls into the principal's office. But I made enough money to buy a couple of new cassettes for the Walkman at the time. So I count that as a success.
Yeah, no, I love that. Yeah, they're like, can you please stop using Sharpie to draw on my kid's arm? That'd be great.
Exactly right.
Too good. Well, yeah, Chris, to kick things off, you alluded to it when talking about Wolves, but would love to just start with some of the basics. Like, what do we even mean when we say early stage startup positioning? What all does that entail?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about how early stage startups can use positioning to find their way to product market fit, right? Like that's the thing that they're all searching for and hunting for. That's what they're trying to figure out. So at its core, positioning is the context you create for a product or your item or service to differentiate yourself in the mind of a prospect. So the goal is to highlight where it stands in relation to alternative solutions in the market, which is in essence that missing quote unquote market fit half of the equation. So more simply, you can think of it as positioning is the key to stand out and sell more.
And so what's kind of the end goal here of your early stage startup positioning exercise? Is it that you can kind of get to that product market fit faster, that you can attract investment faster, waste less time figuring out what resonates in the market? Sort of what's the aim?
Yeah, I mean, you're nailing it, right? Like it's kind of a mixture of all of those things. What people often mix up or don't notice is that the market fit aspect is actually a series of choices. Not many people will get lucky enough to just fall into it. You have to decide what market you actually want to play in. And in order to set yourself up for the best success, you want to think about a category in which your value actually becomes really obvious to those customers or to those prospects. So not everybody thinks that they build a product, it fits into a specific product category. But that's not really the case. And as I'm sure we'll get into in a series of these questions, you can choose most products fit into multiple markets, right? So picking which one makes the most sense, that's half the battle, if not a large portion of it.
Got it. Yeah. And that's one thing I'm interested to dive into a little bit later is because there is this sometimes this tension between the decision of going too narrow too quickly on a specific niche versus just like putting it out to the world and seeing what sticks. So excited to kind of dig into that a little bit later. But first, let's talk about just the process more broadly. And then maybe we dive into each step individually. So how would you outline the typical process for ideating and executing your early stage positioning?
Sure. There are a lot of opinions on this and different ideas of how to position a company versus a product versus a service, right? And most of the traditional models and exercises that do exist, they ultimately help with positioning either directly or indirectly more focused on the supply side. So that's why a lot of companies lead with product descriptions or features starting out. You get the, I made a thing and this is what the thing does. So buy this thing if you want or need to do that. And we actually work in two phases that both shape positioning and work through expressions of it to expose it to the market. So the framework we use to shape positioning focuses on the demand side in order to better align your company or offer with where your customer will actually experience it. So everything we work through with our clients is ultimately about the customer's experience, right? And we never really set out to create a what you define as like a stepped process necessarily for this phase, but over time, it certainly refined itself into one. And we can certainly dig into some of the details there if you'd like.
So it sounds like one big just piece of reorientation that needs to happen is instead of focusing on the supply side and, hey, this is what we do, this is what our product does, just going straight for the demand side. What is it that you're solving for? What is the end result that you're actually providing for that customer from their perspective, not yours?
Yeah, the biggest reason why here, I mean, positioning really isn't a new idea, right? Like it's been around for a while. It was popularized in the 80s. And so it's not a new thing. But when you start to think about it, and we cover this a lot in some of the workshops and some of the conversations we have with clients, but it was when it was popularized in the 80s, it was done as a way to try to create a solution for an oversaturated or an overpopulated market. And it didn't matter which category you were in. So essentially consumers were being met with too many options. And so in order to give yourself a better chance at differentiating within those kind of lookalikes or those multiple tiered sets of options or solutions, they needed a better way to differentiate. And so we talk about this because if they thought it was important in 1981, when the original book on positioning came out, imagine how important it is now after the dawn of the internet, after the dawn of social media, after walking around with computers in our pockets all day, right? Like positioning is a critical factor in the success of a company today.
Let's get into the actual how, right? It sounds like just directionally, there's some key pieces in terms of order of operations that people need to get right. I'm a founder. I want to go out and do my early stage positioning. I want to do it right. I want to focus on the demand side before the supply side. I've done some customer discovery, but it hasn't really been specifically related to my positioning. It was more about honing in on the problem, figuring out, okay, what type of solution should we build? Do I need to do discovery again now that I'm like more specific just on positioning, or do I go back to them with a couple ideas? What do I do?
Yeah, it depends. It certainly could mean doing a different level of discovery. I mean, what we do is we tend to start with we always start with identifying a customer struggle that your solution or offer ultimately resolves. So answering the question of what circumstance does your solution fit into? Now, a lot of founders are doing this, or even product leads are doing this anyway in order to develop their product or service from the beginning. It's just that we have a tendency as we're developing that we get so narrowly focused in on that particular product or service that we stop thinking about how it's going to be experienced. We stop thinking about what are the other alternatives to actually solving the same problem. And so we just get tunnel vision. So we try to go back to that initial moment of what is the circumstance the solution fits into, just to get their heads wrapped around what's the customer facing, right? Like why should we exist? And then next we name what resolving that struggle leads to, right? And we call that the promised land, just to make things simple. So it's what the customer's life could be like on the other side of that struggle. And if anyone listening or you're familiar with the jobs to be done framework, that's what we're really looking to identify here. What is it that's the problem? What's preventing progress in the customer's life that you're potentially able to solve for? And then what's sitting on the other side of that solution? What does life look like? And those are really the critical starting points, right? Because the next piece is where things get more specific and begin to reveal competitive insights. So just to quickly dive into those, the first of which is identifying the alternatives to your solution. And notice that I use the word alternatives rather than direct competitors. And that's because mostly our prospects aren't as well educated in our particular markets as we are as founders, right? So as a founder, you're likely hyper aware of the direct competition you have, but your prospect likely isn't. In fact, if you were to ask them what they'd use if you didn't exist, you'd end up with likely a surprising competitive set that includes things like maybe it's a DIY hack, or it's hiring someone else to figure it out, or even doing nothing about it at all, right? Depending on the category that you're in. So knowing how your customer views their options when confronted with that struggle is crucial to your potential success. And then at that point, the next three steps, and it sounds like there's a lot, there's really seven in total, but the next three steps come more naturally referencing those alternatives to identify your key attributes, the value those attributes enable for customers, and then the description of the best fit customer. And we leave market category, which is an important element, and we touched on that earlier. We leave it for last, and that's because most products and services, as we described earlier, can actually fit within multiple categories, right? Like, is an iPhone a cellular device? Is it a computer? Is it a camera? Like, it fits neatly into each one of those, but which one makes the value of the product stand out? You know, it's only after you've made decisions in those other areas that you have a better idea of which category to place it in.
That's really interesting. And I love the point there around using alternatives instead of competitors, because also often you do see doing nothing is very much a viable option. And when you're in a sales process and you're trying to get these early prospects, that is going to be one of your closed lost reasons for when you move a deal out of the pipeline, is they made a decision and they chose to do nothing. And so it's important to, even if there's not a big switching cost of them going from one piece of software to yours, there still is alternatives out there as opposed to just kind of moving forward with what you've laid out. So I think that's a really important piece of is look broader than just your immediate competitor group and to what the other alternatives look like. Could even be like a DIY Excel sheet that they've put together that's good enough. And now that they've kind of gone through the pain of doing that, they don't really need a software to replace it. So really like that point.
Oh yeah. I mean, like there was a startup that we noticed earlier, and I won't name any names, but they were trying to develop a way to move you from an Excel sheet into their own SaaS model of revenue projections, right? Trying to help you out with investor decks and things like that. And it was interesting because when you really look at it on the surface, you're not solving a problem that doesn't have a solution to it already. It's just that you're providing a tool that makes that solution a little bit more user-friendly to the world. You don't have to develop an expertise within an existing software. It removes some of the burden for those that don't naturally fit into that solution type. And it still provides a solution that you wouldn't otherwise get to on your own, right? Like trying to figure out how to do the math on that and develop the equations and so on and so forth. All of that's really complicated, but being able to use their system, you eliminate 90% of the burden and you just enable the value that comes out on the other side.
Chris, let's dig into, you mentioned these seven kind of fundamental components that really make up your starting point when you're trying to get this exercise off the ground. Why don't we dig into that a little bit more and we can figure out maybe there are pieces where it's a little bit more nebulous and trickier. We can spend more time there, but let's just run a little bit deeper on each of those seven, just to help make this more actionable and more insightful for listeners.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we talked about the first two with the struggle and the promised land, right? And so when you move beyond that, I quickly hit on things in the order. The competitive alternatives comes next. And we've spent some time talking about that because it really is looking at all the different possible solutions that your prospect would take into account. The reason why key attributes comes in after that fact is because now you can start to look at that competitive set, regardless of how unique or surprising it is. You can start to make some decisions about what do you have that they don't. And you're really looking for, it doesn't have to be universal. It doesn't have to be an attribute that all of the potential alternatives don't have. It just has to be something that's different than some of the alternatives or one of the alternatives, because you're ultimately going to have to position from all of those options, right? At least the most likely alternative to you. And then once you have those attributes identified, then you can start thinking about the value. And the value in this case is really talking about what you're enabling for the customer. So people can sometimes get caught up on this depending on where they come into this and what they understand already on the difference between the value that the attributes enable versus like the promised land value, right? The promised land is like a future state. It's your desired future state. The value that you're creating is in what that attribute actually does for you as you're using it. So if you imagine this problem or the struggling moment as this canyon or this divide that somebody has to cross, well, multiple solutions could look like, well, you've developed a plane to get you from point A to point B. You've developed a boat. You built a boat to get you from A to B, or maybe you've built a bridge. So each one of those things enable a different value in the use of them, right? So you're thinking in those terms to develop the value. And then after that, you get a better idea of what customer is actually going to never want to live without you once you've expressed this to them, right? And that's why we look at customer description in this way as being more about your best fit customer, not just a potential customer, because the best fit is what's going to ultimately lead to your growth and to your long-term loyalty. And so your lifetime value stuff. And then when we talk about market category, as we quickly described before, this is really trying to pick an arena that makes your value obvious. So think about how a candy bar looks on a shelf, right? Like you see a candy bar next to a bunch of candy bars, you start making a lot of assumptions about what the candy bar is. You make an assumption about the price, you make an assumption about the delivery of it, like how would I use it? How do I eat it? All that other stuff. You kind of make some assumptions around the types of features that probably exist within the wrapper. And so that category selection means a lot because the end consumer is going to make a lot of assumptions about what your product is given the category you've selected. So you want to be pretty detailed, pretty deliberate.
So I want to ask you a few follow-up questions there. So one, when you're talking about value and what you're enabling for customers, is the focus, sometimes you hear this distinction between focusing on how are you tying yourself to the end goal, right? So if you're, let's say your product streamlines XYZ and this leads to more revenue, okay, great. Let's focus more on revenue versus the streamlining itself. That's sort of more of just the how are you doing it, similar to the plane analogy you were using. Are you focused more in terms of value on, hey, we're getting you from point A to point B faster, which is helping you do XYZ, or are you also kind of getting more into the how? Is that the right way to think about it? I mean, how do you pick that apart?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, using the plane analogy is a pretty good one because ultimately the idea of taking a plane from point A to point B is more about speed, but you give up certain things too, right? Like you don't dictate the schedule itself. So you can't actually decide when you want to leave and when you want to get there. You're bound to something else making that decision for you, a different program versus a bridge, in which case it might take you a little bit longer to get there, but you control all of the other variables. You decide when you start, you decide how long you want to push forward or slow down, you decide if you want to take a break, all of those other things. So there's an added layer of convenience that isn't tied to speed. And then the same thing can be said true of the boat, right? Like maybe the boat isn't necessarily the fastest, maybe it has its own schedule, but maybe it provides an alternative set of values, like it's more scenic or it's more pleasurable or there's less concern because it's not as many people on the boat and you don't have as many other variables that you have to contend with. You don't have to go into an airport, so on and so forth. And I mean, like we're getting a little ridiculous with the example in this, but you can see where once you start to think in these terms, making decisions about the attributes and how those attributes affect the value becomes a little bit more obvious, right? Like one thing leads to the next, which leads to the next, and it becomes this cascading effect versus having to start and stop with every new decision you have to make.
Got it. So kind of circling back to my question, it's really a mix of both. It's thinking about, okay, what's the end result that you're providing? But then also the how is important because that often impacts those attributes that you're referring to.
Correct.
Got it. All right, cool. And then another couple of questions here. So love the point around thinking about your customers, not as, oh, who is a potential customer who might be interested in this, but really who is the best fit, who won't be able to live without this. I think that's an incredibly important point for early stage startups where you are constrained on time, you're constrained on resources, you don't have the luxury of being able to have a million customer interviews and a whole army of salespeople going after every niche of the market. And so I really like that point around getting specific on who are your actual best fit customers you should be targeting. Any other tips for founders as they try to kind of sift through the noise and really narrow in on who those best fit customers are?
Yeah, I mean, like it's easier normally to think about this in terms of like, what would the difference be between an early stage startup and maybe an existing or an established business?
Right? Sure.
Like having the distinction between I have a customer pool to pull from already versus I'm still trying to develop a customer pool. So in that term, really the biggest difference is the ability to source existing customers to help with both the research and validation phases like you're pointing to. But to dig in deeper into that, that's really where the differences end. So everything else is essentially the same, like regardless of whether you have a customer already that can explain their struggle, or you have to talk to who could be a customer about the struggle you're attempting to solve. The choices you make are still largely part of a growing hypothesis of which customers need what option when facing a particular struggle in their lives. So it's only after we've made strategic choices that we begin to place bets in those arenas or in those areas. So we do this by having sales calls with prospects, right? So for somebody that's still trying to determine who's the best fit customer, you really have to have a lot of conversations, right? You have to start talking to people because you have to start to identify those that get really excited about what you're doing versus those that could care less, or maybe they're willing to take a flyer, but it's not something they're willing to focus on. You can also start to find people that already have budgets set aside for it. Right. So in a B2B atmosphere, you're always trying to talk to somebody that's most likely has a budget that they're having to deal with. Do they have something set aside for a solution like yours or not? Pretty good sign of whether or not they can potentially become a good fit for the business. And so it doesn't really matter whether it's the sales call or building out a new landing page or homepage or pursuing media, whether that's paid or not. You want to expose those positioning choices to the market to use it as a test. You want to find out, how do they feel about it? How do they react to it? I would honestly say that one major advantage that early stage companies have in this regard is that they have limited scale. They don't have the same internal processes or organizational structures that hold them back. They can move from a hypothesis to a test much faster. We actually encourage our clients to craft a sales pitch based on the decisions made with positioning as their first true test. Right? And this creates an opportunity for real-time feedback with a range of inputs, including body language, verbal cues, seeing what questions they ask, having direct exposure to how easy or difficult the sell is, right? Like, you can be looking for things like, are they nodding along? Are they leaning into the call? Are the types of questions that they're asking more about the, when can I get it? How much does it cost? What kind of flexibility do I have on the back end? Those kinds of things versus the, I'm not sure I understand what it is that you're talking about. Can we try to explain that a little bit deeper? Right. And so for a small team, the whole process can be done within like a week. Whereas larger, more established teams will often have several internal obstacles to hurdle prior to being able to expose some of those choices to the world, and may even opt for things like focus groups that are going to take more time to build. They've got to schedule those things out, and it all extends the delay from idea to validation.
A couple of things though that really stand out to me. I love the point around using the sales pitch as a feedback mechanism. A couple of things. One, you can do this in parallel with your product development. So as your engineering team's grinding away, this is how you're testing your go-to-market at the same time from a messaging and positioning perspective. And even just the questions they're asking, you can see mentally how far along are they in your sales process? Are they still stuck in the beginning where they're like, huh, like, what do you do? What problem is it solving? I don't really understand the benefits. Or to your point, are they at the end and they're like thinking contract negotiation? What's your pricing? Is any wiggle room there? And at that point, okay, there is some intent here. Like they're interested in getting into the more minutiae and logistics of actually purchasing this versus just getting bought in that this is important and that this is valuable to them. So love that as a tool to kind of get you there. One thing I'm curious about is, so you mentioned startups, obviously much more nimble. It's easier to get this, make these tweaks and iterate more quickly just because there's less red tape. Are you going through this exercise and then testing it all at once? Are you testing it piecemeal? We talked about these kind of seven fundamental components. Are you testing each one as you go and then building on the next? Because I can see, just because this can be a relatively quick process for early stage companies, I could actually see there to be an argument for, yeah, just do them all at once and then test and then go from there. Especially when you think about testing something like market category, there still needs to be some, you know, does this resonate or not in the market? How do you think about iteration as it relates to positioning with this sort of structure that we've outlined?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it's why we actually work in two different phases. I mean, the first phase in everything that we do is about shaping positioning. So it is about answering what fills those gaps, right? Like getting to the answers for the seven components. And we do it isolated for a reason. We want to work through every one of those pieces to see how it influences the next choice from the product owner or from the founder's perspective. Like, what do you know to be true? What do you assume to be true? What's the hypothesis that you're building as to what's going to play in market, so that we can take those fundamental ingredients essentially and then expose it to the market? And so that first expression piece, which is usually fit, like we do this as part of our phase one, and phase two, we start looking at further expressions that'll come after that. But that first piece is the sales pitch, because it gives you that opportunity to test the choices. Because ideally what you're doing and what we do is we take those core components, we use those as a way to structure a sales narrative, if you will, right? Like, we're trying to take all of the things that those things are pointing to And we start to build out this story that we can use in the sales pitch that gives you some fundamental elements that you can push around depending on the prospect that you're talking to, kind of where their mindset is, like how far are they ready to have the sale? Are they just now experiencing the struggle? Have they been experiencing it for a while? You get an idea of where you need to start in that sale, but then you get to use it with them and you get to feel out how they respond to some of those decisions. So are they identifying with the promised land that you've coined for yourself? Does that resonate with them? Does that make sense? If it does, then you're in the right track. Now you can start to feel out, okay, now do the attributes that we acknowledge or even the competitive set that we start to highlight as you might've tried this or you might've tried this and we do this and this because it enables that and that type of thing. Like you can see how the story can be built out pretty rapidly to where you're getting the opportunity to put it in front of somebody and see how they react. We like doing it in this way because if you tried to do each one of those components individually, how many of those actually get exposed to your prospect, right? Like you don't actually have to tell somebody this is the market category we're in, right? The market category that you select is a way to slip that in as subliminal almost context as to why somebody's going to find you in that particular category. And that sets up the other value points. So making those decisions and just positioning wouldn't necessarily be client facing.
Some of this is more strategic, foundational, and what is informing what's actually seen externally. A couple questions just around how this process varies. You already touched on how it varies for early stage versus later stage companies. Curious, any differences between kind of horizontal SaaS and vertical SaaS when it comes to strategy or process differences here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the biggest difference in that situation would actually come from a supply side position. So looking at it from the demand side or customer perspective early, like we do, the struggle you're looking to identify is more universal for the end user. And the orientation of the category will really play or should play less of a role in that case, right? Like one company type that does trip up a lot of founders though, I would say is a marketplace. And that's because you ultimately are selling to two very distinct customers. So in that case, the goal is to identify something universal. So think what Airbnb did as they slowly distilled their position into this idea of trying to belong anywhere or offering a way to belong anywhere, right? Like they were really trying to find alignment between the two halves of that equation. And so from there, then you can create separate doors that each customer type could step through.
Interesting. Okay. So less of a horizontal versus vertical, but actually more of a SaaS versus marketplaces in terms of how this kind of exercise can vary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. What about ICP and buyer persona? Does that change the process at all? Or is it just changing sort of who you're actually iterating and getting in front of as you're collecting feedback and information?
Yeah, it depends on your definition of a buyer persona at that point, right? Like if we're talking demographically, then that's a consideration made at the point of placing media, which would obviously use a downstream expression. But if you mean the customer description of who you're building for, well, then it's a critical component. And the nuance really comes in when you have to decide between the customer, aka the buyer, and the end user or the consumer, right? So for instance, a toy is bought by a parent, but the consumer is a child.
Yep.
So who do you position for, right? And the answer lies in what struggle did you decide best fits with the solution you can offer? So if it's about child education, you're likely positioning for the parent. If it's for entertainment, then you focus on the child, but you can't know who's more important if you don't first work to identify that struggling moment.
And it also probably just kind of going off that same analogy and thinking out, it applies to a lot of the bottoms up SaaS products that you see today, probably often depends as well on price point and how big of a pain this is for the end user versus how big of a pain point it is for the manager or the person who's in that decision-making authority to spend budget on it. Because I can see a situation where if something is cheap enough and a big enough pain point for the end user, then you can kind of leverage that to get the internal dynamics in play so that they're putting upward pressure on people to actually roll this out more broadly and make this something that not in that they can expense and things of that nature versus if it's not as an acute pain point for the end user, but it's a pain for the manager and they're the ones with the budget, then that can also impact just how you're kind of stack ranking them from who you're building for perspective.
Yeah. And I mean, you actually hit on a really interesting problem or hurdle that companies face whenever they're trying to do this, which is the idea of price in general. Ideally, you're never having to compete on price because you've positioned yourself in a way that the value that you're offering isn't tied to the price that it costs to get it. I'm not saying that price doesn't factor in. It always will, right? At some point, a budget takes over And so procurement or whatever it is that you have to go through is going to make that final selection. But you want to be able to present enough value that isn't tied to the actual monetary exchange as possible so that you can get over that hurdle of, well, I have to give up something in order to gain something from the customer. Right? Like the price shouldn't be the biggest concern. If the price was always the concern, if the price was always the barrier, then you wouldn't have luxury products in the market. So when you really consider the idea of luxury versus utility and people are willing to spend 400% margins on something simply because it has a brand name on it, it has less to do with the brand name itself as far as like which name was selected in the beginning and more about the value that they've delivered, at least in the prospect's mind over time. Right? Like they're telling you that this thing is worth that 400% markup because it's X. Right. And so you want to try to move yourself away from the price equation, because if all you're ever doing is selling on price, then you're ultimately selling a losing game, because there's always a competitor that can come into the market, offer a lookalike product and do it at a cheaper price, and it squeezes you out.
If I'm kind of trying to read between the lines here on what you just said, are you alluding to the importance of not only having a hard ROI story, but also a soft ROI story? Or is it more just don't just have a commoditized product where price is king and make sure that you're actually having differentiated features where even if you are selling a hard ROI story, it's not just an easy, you know, replicable product?
Yeah, it's definitely the latter, right? Like I don't make the distinction between soft or hard. It's more about just trying to get to the essence of what makes your particular offer unique so that it can differentiate in that prospect's mind. And that can be done through soft or hard sales pitches, right? It can be done through soft or hard attributes or values. It's about making decisions that can give you that opportunity to occupy that space. And it's a big reason why positioning is hard to adopt, because it's not a one and done thing. This isn't a strategy that you set once and then just assume that it's going to take hold forever. You constantly have to go back and check in on it, because you'll have major disruptions to the market itself. So things like the pandemic, right? Like it came in and devastated hospitality and a ton of other categories. And so they had to fundamentally rethink how things were done. You can look at category mandates from like government restrictions and things like that. Like that's going to make you rethink it. But then you also are just dealing with the typical age old problem of there are new competitors in the market. And so as new competition shows up or new alternatives show up, you have to think about, does my positioning still relate to the customer in the way that I want it to? Do I still differentiate in the ways that I intended to? And so you're constantly going back and checking in on it. And it's the reason why it's so important to do, because the decisions made there and the way that they resonate with your prospect ultimately affect so much more about the company, right? Like there's not really that many functions of the company that positioning won't influence.
All really good points. One piece I want to touch on, Chris, is so we've spent most of the conversation talking about sort of what you would consider phase one in terms of the work that you do, the exercise that you put companies through. Let's touch briefly on this kind of second piece of actually the expression of that positioning. Kind of give us the lay of the land there. When I hear that, I immediately think, okay, I have my message. Now it's just a matter of where and when I'm kind of shouting that out. What channels am I using? Is that what we're talking about? Like how does this kind of manifest itself? Or can you just give us a little bit more color there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like once you shape positioning, you've got to figure out a way to express it to the market itself. So as we talked about before, getting those choices in front of a prospect, for us, we always do a sales narrative or pitch first, which gives us that quick way to test and go back and forth. But everything else about, let's call them your brand assets and ultimately your communication flow from that point forward. So people often get confused because they start thinking about distinctions that have been tried in the world around the idea of like brand positioning versus product positioning versus sales positioning. Like just ignore all that. That's just a bunch of noise, right? There isn't a distinction between positioning. Positioning is positioning, right? But how you then express it after the fact, that starts to get into things like branding and marketing and general communication types. And we tend to focus on the idea of an expression because it really is in all of those little layers that come into play. So most people, they would think an expression would be, okay, so it's going to be my message. Let's say it's even my tagline or something along those lines. It's what my ads look like or the copy that gets used in them. But you could also say, well, then it must be your website as well, right? Your marketing copy that's going to be on that. Actual user experience. What does it feel like to use that entry point? What does it sound like whenever your customer reps talk to prospects, so on and so forth. So it's like all of those things have to build from it. So we start whenever, at least when we're working with clients, we try to focus on some of the major milestones first so that they can see how things start to iterate. So the sales pitch is one version of it because it's the simplest form of the narrative to try to piece those things together in a way that can be expressed to the market. And then from there, you kind of have a good baseline that you can now take that and try it in your basic marketing form. So oftentimes, especially with like a SaaS business, that's going to be the website itself. So think homepage, sales page, something along those lines. You're crafting the copy in a way that now translates the sales pitch into marketing copy. And once you get to that point, then all of a sudden you start looking at how ad copy gets built from that, right? How consumer conversations get built from that, how you could reach back out through email or through social media, what your typical community engagement should feel like. And you can see how this just continues to build on top of itself at that point. And it's why we start so narrow in on the sales pitch itself, because you're eliminating some of the variables that will affect the overall success. You don't have all the visual aesthetics that you have to worry about. You don't have some of the jargon that might slip in as time goes on. You don't have the iterations that come in with campaign development, so on and so forth.
Yeah, really, it sounds, the more you describe it, the more it really sounds like the nucleus of everything else, right? And it also, as a growing startup where you're hiring people, people are joining the team that may not have the same institutional knowledge, you have, you're bringing in outside consultants or marketing agencies or companies like Wolves to help with this process. And having that nucleus can then help inform, it's sort of like the culture, right? It's helping inform all those other decisions that are getting made so that you have a cohesive message, even though you're a fast growing, ever-changing startup.
Yeah, I mean, you've got it right there. Like that's nailing it right on the head, because as you're building in team members, and let's even take that one step further, as you're building in new external partners to come in and help with expressing those decisions, right? Expressing right. Who you are and why you matter. As you're bringing all those people in, they're all going to bring their own perspective. Right? They're all going to bring their own mentality and their own thinking to the table. You hired them for a reason, whether they were an internal hire or an external hire. And so you want to go based on what they're suggesting, or at least you want to like kind of take a flyer on it and see where it goes. But if you don't give them a really good brief to start from, like here's the core stuff that we need to hit on, and this is what we're really about and what we're really trying to sell and why, then they're going to bring their own ideas to the table and they didn't go through the same process you did. And so now you start to see, that's why you get so many different brands and products and services in the market that seem to change drastically from one campaign to the next, or from one website iteration to the next, is because nobody's holding on to the fundamental belief structure of what they started it for the first place and what their consumer is actually trying to solve for. And you're just getting these iterations on top of iterations that aren't really tied to what came before. It's just a new way to say something that's sort of like what came before, versus where you can get with things like, I tie this back to candy bars, Snickers is a great example of this. Like in the 90s, they were experiencing declining sales. And so they went through repositioning specifically from this demand side perspective, and they reversed the trend. And when they did it, it was all through the same series of questions, right? Like, what's the struggle? What's the promised land? What are the alternatives? And then it went from there. And that's what launched this whole idea of Snickers being a food replacement, right? Like a meal replacement. They realized that people were on the go and they didn't have time to stop to eat. And so they needed something to keep them going, yada, yada. So it's not a candy bar anymore, right? And it's not something that I use as a celebration or as a recovery moment. It's not something I do at home in my candy stash. It's something that I need in the middle of the day to get me over one hurdle to the next when I don't have time to do it the right way. And when they realized that, when they realized that was where they fit, that launched the next 30 years of campaign development that all feel a lot like the original campaign. Right? Like Snickers Satisfies isn't all that different from Betty White's You're Not You When You're Hungry. They're essentially the same idea. And so that's the power of this stuff, is that once you get to the expression side of it, it can easily tie in to where it started at the foundational choices.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you about, Chris, before we get into final tips and tricks, let's talk about some of the common mistakes early stage startups make when it comes to their positioning, whether it's creating it, whether it's pushing it out into the marketplace. Feel free to hone in on different steps if you see there are certain, you know, components where people tend to get hung up, but would love to just be able to learn from some common mistakes that you see so that listeners can avoid those.
Yeah, I mean, the most obvious is that they never deliberately do it, right? Or they fill in the kind of like generic Mad Lib positioning statement or value proposition exercise, and they think that they've done positioning, which that really leads to a number of problems. So the first being that your customer will do it for you, and that rarely works to your benefit, right? In the case of Snickers, if we just allow them to think that we're a candy bar, then we're always a candy bar. We're nothing beyond that. But also without it, you have little reference as a company for what you say yes and no to moving forward. So should we run this ad or that one? Is this customer segment better? Will this copy resonate with our audience? And so on and so forth, right? Like what we talked about before. And then the next, it leads to like the idea of just a generic positioning statement or the value proposition framework. It leads to supply side positioning as a default, because those templates rely on product-led assumptions and they don't really take into account how the customer actually experiences you in a chosen market. And more importantly, when you do that, most of the time it leaves little to refer back to, and it almost serves as like a placeholder for your elevator pitch. You don't see the value in it beyond that, right? Like there's not enough context built into the choices that you've made to make it a resource or a reference point for anybody. So at best, it shows up in a company deck somewhere on a shelf that nobody ever looks at, or maybe a new hire glances at, but it's never really all that helpful. And in either case, the decision or lack thereof one, it also affects your product roadmaps and prioritization. So it's something that we hadn't even talked about before. Like if you look to the example of Snickers, instead of trying on new product features to try to reverse their sales, they were really trying to better understand why would a customer buy them in the first place. And once they understood that it was about a meal replacement, then they had a better idea of why their product was being selected and things that they could do to the product if they ultimately wanted to. So like imagine the idea of if somebody came into the Snickers or into the product team, right? He said, I have a great idea. I want to actually suggest that we infuse CBD oil into a Snickers bar and see what happens. Like, does that even make sense to do that? Right? Like CBD would be meant more to like mellow them out or calm them down. It would dull the effects of what the Snickers is actually being used for. Whereas if you look at the exact opposite of that and somebody came in and said, well, what if we infuse caffeine into the product? Well, now all of a sudden it makes complete sense, right? Like, of course we should try that. Of course that makes sense for our customer. That would be a natural, attractive point for them to give it a shot. Right. And you could potentially launch an entirely new product line based on that if it sold well. So once you kind of get this stuff dialed in, that's what's amazing about positioning is how much it affects. So from marketing, sales and business development, customer success, product development, the better you understand it, the more successful those bets are ultimately going to become. So I think getting back to the question as I rambled through that, common mistakes, like just make sure you take the time to actually set it. Don't assume that it's not important. Don't ignore it. I understand that the solutions that exist as a generic template are tricky and as a default, difficult to set up and get through, but it's still worth taking the time to do it, whether you hire an expert like our firm or not.
It's an interesting point coming full circle here, talking about the supply side positioning being oftentimes just the kind of default by nature of what we tend to do. Because if you're the founder, look, you know your product well, you know your space well. So it's easy to talk about what your product, your features are trying to solve for, as opposed to what you're going to do for that end customer and kind of coming more from their perspective. But it also, when you actually kind of step back and look at it, it's so obvious why that doesn't work, especially when you're a new company, because people don't even know who you are yet. And so if all you're talking about is your product and you're talking about how great your product features are, once you're a huge company and you're Coca-Cola or you're Snickers and you're talking about these products, okay, people are listening, right? They're like, oh, cool. I can maybe connect those dots myself. But when they've never even heard of you and you're just blabbering away about yourself, it just doesn't land.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's why you don't get, at least not that much anymore. You don't get a lot of the we're number one in X kind of thing, or even that we're trying to become number one in X, because the only people that actually helps are the people that already own that market share, right? Like if you're controlling 70%+ of the available market, then you can say whatever you want and you're still going to pull in sales, right? Because you're the default option at that point. What we're talking about is really ways to try to unseat them, or more importantly, stand out against them, right? If your product potentially could be absorbed into a larger competitor that solves some of the same things, if not the exact same things, then you need a way to differentiate that's not something like we're cheaper or our customer success is better or we're easier to use. Like you have to find real value points that make you more valuable to the end user than just the default option.
It's also interesting because when you think about the demand side, it's almost like the more primitive piece that's closer to the actual set of experiences of your customer, using that example of, well, we have better customer success. You're then kind of relying on them of having a poor customer success experience with a competitor so that they actually know what that means and why that matters, as opposed to talking their language and talking about problems that they're facing today. It's like the more rudimentary fundamental problems that they need to solve first. And then everything else is more like featurey. And it's just kind of the added bonus.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, I laugh. There's a really good talk. I'm blanking on the name of it now. If I remember, I'll have to share it with you. But they do a great job of trying to explain the idea of what's happened to like SaaS products in the sense that it's, you know, clean or it's minimal or that we're really easy to use and things like that. And it's like, they don't really lead to anything, right? Like you have to have the exact opposite experience for that to mean anything. In what case would you actually know that you can accurately predict that their assumption of what you're talking about mirrors to what their actual experience was? Get beyond some of those obvious surface level touches are, and especially if they're more aesthetic or more personal to the founder, you have to think through something deeper than that.
Right. Right. Sounds like great to have in your appendix. Like, yeah. How's your customer success? It's great. It's much better than the competition. Here's why, but not part of the main pitch. All right. Yeah. So Chris, we'll love to hear about any additional resources that you like to point folks in the direction of, as well as just any final thoughts, tips, or tricks you want to leave folks with to summarize.
Yeah. And for anybody that really wants to dive in deeper on the topic of positioning, there's a lot of things that you can look at. There's some pretty good books that talk about the idea of it or the genesis of it. So that would include things like Reason Trout's Positioning, The Battle for Your Mind, right? Like that was the book from the 80s that kind of set this whole thing off. And there's some new ones as well that detail some of the order in which we talked about today. So I'd encourage anybody that's interested in it, that just wants to get their feet wet, just to do some searches in general. Like you'll find some pretty decent resources out there. I think that to that end, one thing that we've actually been trying to figure out on our own, which may sound like kind of a selfish plug at this point, but because we focus on early stage founders, some of them fit into the category of, okay, we're ready to hire in experts, and others fit into the category of, I still need something that feels much more bootstrapped in nature. Like what's the cheapest option that gets me from point A to point B type of thing. So we're actually in the process of trying to develop our own kind of masterclass or course for the same purpose. So as that gets built out and we have it ready to launch, maybe we can do something for the listeners here. But I think that beyond those, the tips that I would say is just at the very minimum, like every founder should start with identifying a customer struggle, the root cause of why somebody's looking for you that you can solve. And then imagine that promised land, right? Like, what is it that you believe can uniquely provide a path to that promised land? If you can get just those connection points in your head, a lot of the other stuff starts to fit into place a little bit more naturally. I'm not saying that it's a foolproof plan, but it's certainly the place that I would start. It takes a while to decide on it. You do have to actually have that kind of courage, right? To go, okay, I'm going to go all in on this, at least to the point of I'm going to have several sales calls and test it as real positioning and not necessarily as a, hey, what if we did X? Right? Like just have the confidence to say, this is what we're doing and see what the response is.
I love that. I think that's a really great point to end on. Try to get the authentic feedback. Don't cop out with, what if we said it was like this? I think that's a really, really good point. Chris, you've shared so many great tips and tricks with us and love this process that you've laid out for listeners to go follow. Thank you so much for spending time with us and coming on the show.
Yeah, man, it was a pleasure. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. Up your face.